serving in Babylon, Daniel's story. Well, the UK has had a glorious Christian history that's had a profound influence in shaping our language, our culture, our laws, our institutions, and not least also for the medics here, our medical schools and hospitals. And Christian involvement in healthcare and in law has a long pedigree in the UK and elsewhere that stretches right back to the monastic hospitals of the medieval period. And in fact, many of the major hospitals which provided the foundation for the NHS when it was first set up were originally set up by Christian believers. St. Bartholomew's, St. Thomas's here, and you can see Parliament in the background, the scenes of those terrible events last week, St. Mary's and St. George's, they're examples just in London. And similarly, many of the country's leading medical schools began with Christian initiatives. But anyone observing political events in the UK today will be very clear that we are now living very much in a post-Christian society, and we're living in a post-Christian health service. And the mountains of our culture, by that I mean those institutions which shape our culture's trajectory, Parliament, the judiciary, the universities, schools, the worlds of media, art, and entertainment, these are now increasingly occupied by people who hold to an atheistic worldview and to the values of secular humanism. God doesn't exist. Man is a clever monkey. Death is the end. Morality is something that is discovered, not revealed, by a higher power. And we talk about the sacred triad of humanism: autonomy, which says, I want it; technology, which says, we can do it; and then moral relativism, which says, why not? When you think about any issue, the things particularly that we're going to focus on later today, it's those three questions which are driving and determining our nation's direction. Same-sex marriage, abortion on demand, not yet realities here in Northern Ireland, but threatening now. In a way that they never have before. The relentless push for legalized euthanasia, materialism, crippling debt, and self-absorption are all in themselves symptoms of a collective loss of Christian faith. And this cultural decline, atheism leading to immorality, to idolatry, especially sexual immorality, was of course very clearly spelt out and described by Paul in the first century. In Romans 1, we read about the three exchanges. They exchanged the worship of God for idols. They exchanged truth for lies. They exchanged natural relations for unnatural ones. And also, soberly mapped out by the prophet Ezekiel many centuries before, describing the terminal moral decline of the Jewish people at that time prior to the exile. And this is what he says: this was the sin of your sister Sodom. And he's talking here about Jerusalem, the nation of Judah. Your sister was Sodom. She and her daughters were arrogant, overfed, and unconcerned. They did not help the poor and needy. What a beautiful description of the Western world today, perhaps. They were haughty and did detestable things before me, therefore I did away with them, as you've seen. So we see there was sexual immorality, but there was also self-absorption, materialism. And elsewhere in the Old Testament, the prophets, of course, outline the four main markers of a culture that is experiencing its death throes. There's flagrant idolatry, where things other than God take his place. Sexual immorality, the second marker. The third one, the shedding of innocent blood, in whatever form. and an arrogant self-righteousness, a self-justification. And one of the most reliable barometers of this cultural shift is in the changing composition and character of UK parliaments, and especially the House of Lords, which over the last 7 years since 2010 has become a rubber stamp, in a sense, for any measures which resonate with the new atheist zeitgeist. Rather than a chamber which is offering careful scrutiny of new laws, this unelected and unaccountable body is now actually taking the lead in introducing and rubber stamping so-called progressive legislation. So it voted back in 2013 to legalize same-sex marriage, a year later to legalize three-parent embryo techniques involving both germline genetic manipulation and also cell nuclear replacement, otherwise known as cloning technology, by an incredible majority of 280 to 48. Incidentally, if you can't hear at the back, do feel free to come forward. I understand this is not for magnification in my voice, but just for recording. So in that same year, 2014, the House of Commons, led by the then Prime Minister David Cameron and the Vice Leader of the Labour Party, astoundingly rejected a move by Fiona Bruce MP, Christian MP and lawyer, to clarify that sex selection abortion was illegal in England and Wales. And they did this by an astounding 292 to 201 majority. Which parliament would balk at criminalizing female gendercide? Well, ours just has. Lord Falconer's assisted dying bill, this is him on the right here, thankfully fell just before the general election in 2015 through lack of parliamentary time and at committee stage. But there was very little doubt in the minds of those of us who were working closely on this that it would have passed through the House of Lords had time been granted. Now, thankfully, the Maris bill in the Commons was defeated by an overwhelming majority later that year, as was the Harvey bill in Scotland. But the issue hasn't gone away, and new threats in Westminster now include the imposition of very vaguely defined British values. We can all buy into democracy and the rule of law and so on, but what is diversity and tolerance? These British values now include, it seems, enforcing political correctness with respect especially to homosexuality and transgender ideology, sex education, so on, and the complete decriminalization of abortion, which we're now seeing a move for in the Western Parliament with the Johnson Bill. And of course, here in Northern Ireland, you face new pressures to liberalize the abortion law and to legalize same-sex marriage. You're expecting probably these things to come back this year. So the question is, how are we to live in a society that has lost its cultural foundations and now increasingly is inimical to both Christian faith and values? How are we to live when we find ourselves increasingly as aliens and strangers in our own country? And it's precisely for this kind of situation that the story of Daniel is so instructive. And we can forget that when Paul instructed Timothy that all scripture is inspired by God and it's useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting, and training in righteousness so that the servant of God may be thoroughly equipped for every good work, he was actually talking about the Old Testament, because the New Testament was not yet in existence. And the very same apostle, when writing to the Corinthians, said these things happened, 1 Corinthians 10:11. And he's talking about events in Old Testament times to them as examples, and they were written down as warnings to us on whom the culmination of the ages has come. So they were deeply students of the Old Testament. So let me take you back, let's journey back together 2,600 years in history. And when Jerusalem fell to the Babylonians in 587 BC, the nation of Judah was taken to Babylon in an exile. It was going to last for 70 years altogether. And as God's people in a country that was hostile to their faith and values, they faced the challenge of living and serving as aliens and strangers. There was great pressure to close ranks or to forget who they were. There's also great lament. Now, I'm perhaps showing my age here, but some of you are smiling who were teenagers in the 1970s, but these emotions, of course, that the Jewish people felt are beautifully described in Psalm 137 in words that were given currency by this rather strange band called Boney M, a German-based but ethnically Jamaican foursome who achieved popularity, or we might say notoriety, back in the 1970s. But in King James English, by the rivers of Babylon, we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. So the psalm goes on then to describe in graphic detail how they were tormented by their captors, how they were unable to sing the songs of their homeland. They were pining for Jerusalem, and they were longing for vengeance against those who had mistreated them. They were forcibly displaced people. Not even asylum seekers and refugees, let alone economic migrants, but rather captives, prisoners of war, in a country utterly different from their own in language and culture, in values, religion, and in worldview. God's people, but made to serve in an idolatrous empire, Babylon. And it's very interesting in the New Testament that we see the symbolism of Babylon is used by the apostles to describe Christians' position in the world in the first century. The apostle Peter talks of living in Babylon, although this city had been in ruins for 4 centuries. At that time, he describes God's elect Christian believers as strangers in the world and aliens, 1 Peter 1 and 1 Peter 2. And so he calls them to be holy, to be set apart, because they are a chosen people, a royal priesthood and a holy nation, calling back into remembrance, Peter does, words from right back in the book of Exodus. And one of the key themes of the book of Daniel, we see the outline of the chapters here, is that God is utterly sovereign over all physical, spiritual, social, and political processes as well. In other words, to put it bluntly, fire cannot burn, lions cannot bite, and kings cannot rule unless God allows them to do it. And God's rescue of Daniel from the lion's den in Daniel chapter 6, and of his friends Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from the fiery furnace in Daniel chapter 3 are very familiar to anyone who has attended Sunday school, much more familiar, I would think, to people in Northern Ireland than they are in England and Wales now, where only 3% attend Sunday school. But much less appreciated or believed in, even in the church, is God's control over political events and his sovereignty over the rise and the fall of nations. So we're told he changes times and seasons. He deposes kings and raises up others. And this second scripture here that I've got on the slide, the Most High is sovereign over all the kingdoms on earth, and he gives them to anyone he wishes. Daniel 4:32, but it's repeated in 4:17, 4:25, 5:21, and 5:35. It's the recurrent theme all the way through this book. And Daniel's two great dreams in chapters 2 and 7 of this book illustrate this. So first, we have the dream of the great statue in chapter 2. with its head of gold, its chest of silver, its loins of bronze, and its legs of iron, representing the kingdom of Babylon and three more empires, usually identified by commentators as Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, that follow on from Babylon. Then there are the four great beasts of chapter 7, representing probably the same four kingdoms, each falling to be replaced by the next. And each dream ends in a similar way, with these temporary earthly kingdoms being destroyed to be replaced by a heavenly kingdom that will never end. So the statue made out of these four metals is smashed by a rock, which then grows to fill the whole world, a direct reference to Christ's kingdom. And the four beasts are superseded by one, we're told, like a son of man, Daniel 7:13, coming with the clouds of heaven. And he approaches the Ancient of Days, God the Father, and he's led into his presence. And then the Son of Man is given authority, glory and sovereign power. We're told all nations and peoples of every language worship him, and his dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. And the Son of Man, of course, was Jesus's favorite term for himself in the Gospels. And it was Jesus, through his death and resurrection, rules over all the kingdoms of men. So God is utterly sovereign over political processes and everything else. Well, currently I live in St. Albans in southeast England. You may have heard of it. We've been there a long time now, 25 years. It's named after Britain's first Christian martyr, a Roman nobleman, surprisingly called Alban. And he was converted through the ministry of a priest in the early 3rd century when this priest was fleeing persecution. And when he refused to recant, the Roman officials chopped his head off. That's the story. But centuries later, when the Roman town of Verulamium, which at that time was the third biggest Roman town in the whole of Britain, when it lay in ruins, they took the bricks and they used them to build a cathedral on the very spot where Alban had lost his life. And you can still walk into St. Alban's Cathedral now and see the Roman bricks in the nave. And whenever I go there, I think it's a beautiful picture of what has and is happening throughout history. That through the shedding of Jesus's own blood at the hands of the Roman Empire, God is building a living temple of his own people, the church. The sovereignty, the power and greatness of all the kingdoms under heaven will be handed over to the holy people of the Most High, and his kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. So this is, of course, the direction in which we're moving. And of course, what's true of the ancient empires of Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome is equally true of the empires of today. American, British, Soviet empires, and equally the empires of post-war Western capitalism and Islam. God has raised them all up, and he will bring them all down. So God is not only sovereign over his own people. Yes, he brought the nation of Israel out of captivity in Egypt, and he planted them in the promised land. But as the prophet Amos tells us, Amos 9:7, he also brought the Philistines up from Kaphtor, what we know as Crete, and the Arameans from Kir. Every migration of human peoples is ultimately God's doing. And as the Apostle Paul reminds us, from one man God made all the nations that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he marked out the appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. So God is sovereign over all political events, just as he's sovereign over all events of any kind, even over the NHS and over the movements of the legal profession. This you might recognize if you've been to Athens. This is Mars Hill, the Areopagus, as we know it from Acts chapter 17. And there's you can see a bronze plaque there in the bottom right-hand corner, and that is Paul's sermon in Greek that's there on the hill. And of course, this is the very hill where he spoke to them. Now, I visited this a couple of years ago, and what I didn't know, you stand on this hill, you look down into the marketplace where he got into the conversation that brought him up to this place where the leaders met. But this sits right under the Acropolis with all those temples worshipping gods in a society, the Greek Empire, which now lies in absolute ruin. So this was the place that Jesus that Paul was preaching, God's sovereignty over all political events. So he's sovereign over all political events, and in like manner, the Jews did not end up in Babylon by some mistake or historical accident, and certainly not by the design of Babylon itself. God himself put them there. And of course, this is the way the book of Daniel starts. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. That's how Daniel and his friends got there to Babylon in the first place. And by 605 BC, when the book of Daniel starts, Babylon was the most powerful city in the world. It was the capital of the Babylonian Empire, which stretched all the way from Egypt, as we know it now, in the south, to Armenia in the north, from Turkey in the west, right across to Iran. And Babylon ruled all the nations, rather like Moscow used to rule the whole of the USSR. 100,000 people, a lot of people in those days, 1,200 temples, home of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon and the famous Ishtar Gate with its beautiful blue mosaics, which is today reconstructed in Berlin's Pergamon Museum. I got into a lot of trouble for trying to photograph it there from a very large Fraulein with a stick and a uniform. But Babylon was the world leader in science and art and astronomy and literature, engineering, and of course preeminent in political and military strength. And Judah was just one of many, many nations that it crushed. And Daniel is a character eminently worthy of study. Ponder this. He rises to be prime minister in a country whose language and culture were at first completely unfamiliar to him. Absolutely astounding. He serves seven kings as a leading official through two great empires, not just Babylon, but Media as well. He's visited by angels. He receives more dreams and visions from God than any other Old Testament character, and yet he remains faithful to God through great tests of faith as well. So it's said that all power corrupts and that absolute power corrupts absolutely, but we see no trace of it here. Daniel had absolute power, and yet despite all the corruption and power-seeking and idolatry in Babylon, he remained untainted. And yet this remarkable man, by God's grace, was also a very humble man with a simple approach to life. He simply read his Bible, prayed, and obeyed God in any situation in which he placed himself. And I think his situation has many similarities with ours as Christian lawyers or doctors or other health professionals. We read in Daniel 1:3-7 that Daniel and his friends were selected for a period of religious training. They were taken apart from their home and their family back in Jerusalem. They had to acquire new language and skills, the language and literature of the Babylonians, Arcadian, cuneiform, quite difficult. They were employed by the state in a very privileged position, and they faced huge pressure to conform to the society in which they've been placed. And there were, in many ways, model citizens who had a huge respect for the authorities and hierarchical structures they were asked to serve in, but they were also actually citizens of another kingdom altogether, the kingdom of God. So in Babylon, they were aliens, exiles, sojourners, strangers, awaiting the coming of their real kingdom when they would return to Jerusalem, just as we're waiting to be taken out of our, or taken to our new Jerusalem when it arrives with Christ. So as God's people, they had to live, as we do, in this tension between the now and the not yet. God's kingdom has been inaugurated through Christ's death and resurrection and the birth of the church, but it will not come fully until Christ returns in judgment. So Christians are therefore called both to be in the world whilst being not of the world. John 17, we see, we do not belong to the world, but we've been chosen out of the world. So the world is not our real home. We're citizens of a different kingdom serving a different king. And in this situation, Daniel and his friends faced two key temptations. The first one was to retreat into their escapist spiritual ghettos. But when I was a medical student in Auckland, and Michael Griffiths, who was then heading up IFES, some of you might remember him, came and he told us that our cell groups were escapist ghettos for caring and sharing. I've never forgotten that. This is what he was getting at, the temptation. So to seek solace, if you like, with like-minded believers and to leave the world entirely to its own devices, that's one temptation in Babylon. And the second temptation is simply to compromise and become no different from those around you. And we face exactly these same temptations today, I believe, to withdraw into our Christian communities on the one hand, or to blend in with the world around us on the other. But like Daniel, we're called instead to be fully engaged with the society into which we've been placed, to be both salt and light, penetrating and flavoring, and to shine like stars, to stand out as morally different. And of course, being engaged with the society involves a degree of conformity. Daniel and his friends learned to trade. They adopted clothing and culture. They learned a new language. They served in a secular state, but it also involved daring to be different. And the first challenge they face in chapter 1 is to eat the king's rich food, something they felt as believers they could not do. And they felt for some reason it would be dishonoring to God. And commentators will argue about this and come to different conclusions. Was it because the food was not kosher? Was it that it had been sacrificed to idols? Was it simply bad for them? We're not told specifically. But nevertheless, they concluded that for whatever reason, it would be wrong for them to eat it. And this first challenge was one in which they risked embarrassment, but not much else. But it was the first of many steps that would eventually take them to the fiery furnace and the lion's den. And in the same way, there are steps of faithfulness to God for us that might make us unpopular with others or risk embarrassment, marginalization, where we need to take a different path from those around us in terms of lifestyle. I think we all face this in a big way at university increasingly now. The misuse of drugs or alcohol, sexual boundaries, issues around the way we use our money, honesty, speech, refusing to join in with gossip, capitulate to cynicism, run others down, complain, whinging, whining, moaning, and complaining. I'm sure you don't do this on this side of the Irish Sea, but it's an endemic sin in that other place. And it's striking, isn't it, that Paul's exhortation in the book of Philippians for the church in Philippi to shine like stars in Philippians 2:14 and 15 is in the context of doing everything without grumbling or arguing, so that you, in his words, might become blameless and pure, children of God without fault in a warped and crooked generation. The importance of speech, what we say in the presence of others. And then there are steps of faithfulness, apart from these lifestyle issues, where the stakes are considerably raised, when it's not just reputation or friendship or popularity that's at stake, but something much more: our jobs, our comfort, our property, our freedom, perhaps also ultimately our lives. And it's interesting that the situations that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego face in chapter 3 with the fiery furnace, and that Daniel faces in chapter 6 with the lion's den, both involve changes in the law. So in chapter 3, the law changes in a way that forces these believers to do something that they believe is wrong, or to pay the price. In this case, it's to bow down to an idolatrous image. And in the UK today, there are changes in the law threatening to do just that, to force us to act against our consciences, especially with regard to the area of life ethics. Abortion is an obvious example. On the other side of the Irish Sea, Christians risk being effectively marginalized from some specialties in medicine. Currently in CMF, we're fighting a change being proposed by the General Pharmaceutical Council, the regulatory body for pharmacists, and they're wanting to change from what is effectively a right to refer system for emergency contraception and other treatments to a duty to dispense system. And this is going to affect not just emergency contraception, but also, ponder on this, gender reassignment hormones, puberty suppressants, so-called pre-exposure prophylaxis for HIV. And if the law were to change, of course, to allow euthanasia or assisted suicide or abortion on demand, making it part of what we call the full range of services that people in the health service are obliged to provide, then there would be pressure to conform of a very different kind. And the thing about the Johnson bill, which you may have heard of, which seeks completely to decriminalize abortion in Britain, will, at a stroke, if it does eventually go through, take away the conscience clause altogether. And of course, pharmacists, and it will take away the premises clause, which asks that abortion be done in certain approved places. So would legalize home abortion, and then community pharmacists, of course, will be in the firing line for that as well. So that's a chapter 3 type change, forcing believers to do something they believe is morally wrong. And then in chapter 6, the law changes in a way that threatens to stop these people, Daniel in particular, participating in what is completely normal behavior for believers. For Daniel, it was to pray with his window open toward Jerusalem. And in the same way, it might be for us to pray in public or with patience, to share our faith, to express an opinion about an ethical issue, perhaps even wearing a cross. And the Apostle Paul, of course, is quite unambiguous in telling the Roman Christians to submit to the governing authorities. We're all familiar with that, Romans 13. And the context was of a Roman Empire at that time, which was hostile to Christian faith. And he makes his argument, even in this context, that governments have been established by God and that they are to be obeyed. But this is not a call for unthinking, unquestioning obedience. The Bible is equally very clear about red lines, that we should not submit to obeying governing authorities when they force us to do things that are wrong, or they try to prevent us from living and speaking in obedience to Jesus Christ. And, you know, just think of some of the examples. The Israelite midwives back in Exodus chapter 1, they refused to kill the Israelite babies when the king of Egypt ordered them to do so. Rahab the harlot refused to hand over the Israelite spies to the king of Jericho, even though he was her king. Daniel disobeyed King Darius when he told him to desist from public prayer. And his friends Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did not bow down to Nebuchadnezzar's golden image. Now, the Apostle Peter says, we must obey God rather than men when the high priest and the Sanhedrin order him and his fellow apostles not to preach the gospel. There were red lines. And the response of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, I think, is particularly striking. Bow down to the altar, or we'll throw you in the fiery furnace. King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. Remember, they're saying this as officials in a high position of authority to this the boss. If we're thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from us, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, and there was no certainty in their mind about this, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you've set up. But even if he does not, and the King James Version puts it even more starkly, but if not. In the summer of 1940, before even I was alive, more than 350,000 soldiers, most of them British, were trapped at Dunkirk. The German forces were on their way. They had the capacity to wipe out the British Expeditionary Force altogether. And when it seemed certain that the Allied troops at Dunkirk were about to be massacred, a British naval officer cabled just three words back to London. But if not. Now, these words were instantly recognizable to the people who were accustomed to hearing the scriptures being read in church. They wouldn't be recognized today. But they knew the story told in the book of Daniel, and the message in those three little words was abundantly clear. The situation was desperate. The Allied forces were trapped. It would take a miracle to save them, but they were determined not to give off, not to give in. And what those simple three words just communicated all of that. But if not. And for some reason, people are still not sure why the Axis powers hesitated. I think it was one of the three occasions when Churchill called the whole nation to prayer. They backed off briefly, and what's known as the Miracle of Dunkirk took place, and British families and fishermen heard about the cry for help, and they answered with merchant marine boats, with pleasure cruisers, and even with small fishing boats, and by a miracle they evacuated more than 338,000 troops and took them to safety. Now, of course, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did not know whether God would save them or intervene with a miracle, as he actually did on this occasion. We notice he didn't intervene to stop Isaiah being sawn in half by King Manasseh or various other people who did give their lives. And we see in the long list of heroes in Hebrews 11 that some were delivered and some weren't. But the point is that all were faithful in not bending the knee. So they didn't know whether he'd intervene, but regardless, they weren't going to bow down to the image. And in the same way, we need to count the cost of obedience and be prepared to pay it. Do we know our red lines, the things that we're not going to cross? Are we clear on those? And then there was the second challenge, which was about engagement, seeking the common good. So daring to be different, of course, is a key element of Christian discipleship, but there was another component of Daniel's faithfulness to God. And the prophet Jeremiah, who was a contemporary of Daniel, urged the exiles, including Daniel and his friends, they would have received his communications, to become fully engaged with their new society whilst maintaining their distinctiveness as believers faithful to God, to be truly, if you like, in the world but not of the world. And we see this this passage in Jeremiah 29, 7 to 11. Seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I've carried you in exile. Pray to the Lord for it, for if it prospers, you too will prosper. For I know, and these are the words we know, but we often lift them out of context and forget the context. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future. It was in the context of living in Babylon that they received this. And so Daniel and his friends worked hard and effectively within this Babylonian system, and they were rewarded as well with great responsibility for their integrity and commitment. This is wouldn't you like to have an epitaph like this? Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. They tried to find grounds for charges against him in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Now, everyone wants subjects like this. And in fact, if we look of what the book says about his friends, this was true of all of them. And the Bible, of course, makes very clear where these qualities came from. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to them. So they entered the king's service, and every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters of his whole kingdom. And the result, well, we read that the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in their presence in the province of Babylon. Of course, there's nothing wrong with Christians holding influential positions of authority. It can enable us to do great good. But the key thing is to make sure that it's God and not selfish ambition that puts us there. Because if we have to compromise to get into positions of authority, we will have to compromise to stay there. On the other hand, if it's God who puts us there, then he can do equally great things through us. And for much of biblical history, of course, God's people have lived as exiles and have worked in state systems, not just Babylon. So we had Joseph in Egypt. We had Esther and Mordecai in Persia. We had Nehemiah living during the Medo-Persian Empire, also serving in a state system. And the early Christians, of course, lived at the time when the Roman Empire was dominant, and throughout the last 20 centuries, they've served in state systems and empires all over the world. And of course, we should work to the best of our abilities within the system in which we've been placed and value the good of the organization in which we work, whether it's a legal chambers or an NHS institution. And in doing this, we're not only obeying the principles to seek the good of the city in Jeremiah 29, but we're also upholding the very high view of work that we see right back in the pages of Genesis 1. As God's stewards, we're entrusted with gifts, with training, with resources, and we're held responsible to care for the world, God's world, as he himself cares for it, not to exploit it. We should make an effort to help with particular priorities in our organization, seeking to improve the quality of its work. This might include providing leadership, balancing finances, learning management processes, and promoting what our organization does. And of course, one way is to become involved in the management structures and work on improving the system. The latest NHS reforms have given many more opportunities and authority to general practitioners, especially. Indeed, in a way that wasn't true a few years ago, doctors are managers to a greater or lesser extent. Lawyers perhaps have always been. And principles around integrity and seeking the good of our workplaces are no different when applied to management tasks than when applied to patient care. And part, of course, of seeking that prosperity and the good of the city is praying. If there are other Christians, are we praying together in our workplace? Are we praying? Of course, we may well pray for our patients and our clients and ourselves, but how often do we pray for the health of the organization and the managers who lead it? And Christians are urged not only to pray for all those in authority, 1 Timothy 2, but also to be subject to them, to be obedient, to be ready to do whatever's good, to slander no one, to be peaceable and considerate, to show humility to all men. We're also asked to serve them with sincerity of heart and with reverence for the Lord, as if working for the Lord and not for men, loving as Christ loved, treating others as if they were Christ himself. And as we've noted, Christian involvement in healthcare has a long pedigree in the UK. We wouldn't have an NHS if it was not for its Christian foundations, because when the NHS was created, they just took Christian institutions and nationalized them effectively. Perhaps the reason why they're not working as well today. And many Christians will quite rightly continue to work in the state healthcare institutions of the NHS. But given the global financial crisis and burgeoning national debt, there are also going to be many more opportunities for Christian doctors and other health professionals to provide health care in innovative ways through churches, communities, charities, and corporate bodies alongside. The Chinese character for crisis is made up of two other characters, threat and opportunity. So the idea is that behind every grey cloud of threat, there's a silver lining of opportunity if you can see it and grasp it. And of course, if the health system is in crisis, it poses a threat to us, but also gives opportunities for Christian believers and explicitly for Christian organizations to provide healthcare and health education. Cameron's Big Society of 2010 was perhaps always doomed to failure. It's become a footnote in history, but isn't it striking that the astronomic growth in Christian initiatives since 2010. We see this all over the UK. Food banks, street pastoring, debt counselling, crisis pregnancy counselling, drug and alcohol rehabilitation. All of these represent Christians seeing the gaps and rising to that challenge. But I think there's unlimited potential also by God's grace for service at a much higher professional level by the church, through charities, through churches, and through corporate bodies. We're perhaps in a way being infantilized by the NHS in believing that the state does it all for us, when in fact we used to do it for them. So this is from the Mount of Olives, looking across to Jerusalem today. And of course, this was the site where Jesus preached what we know as the Olivet Discourse just before he went to the cross, telling his disciples what would happen. And we live in this period between Jesus's first coming, and in which he achieved our salvation through his death and resurrection, and his second coming, leading to the final judgment and the establishment of a new heaven and new earth. And we know that in the final days before Christ's return, there will be days of great turmoil and torment. In the book of Revelation, John describes the final death of human culture, which he calls Babylon the Great, interestingly, epitomizing a state in full rebellion against God. Fallen is Babylon the Great, which made the nations drink the maddening wine of her adulteries. Revelation 14:8, 16:9, God remembered Babylon the Great and gave her the cup filled with the wine of the fury of his wrath. Revelation 17:5, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and the abominations of the earth. 18:2, with a mighty voice he shouted, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She's become a dwelling for demons and a haunt for every impure spirit." Revelation 18:9, when the kings of earth who committed adultery with her and shared her luxury see the smoke of her burning, they'll weep and mourn over her. 18:10, woe to you, great city, you mighty city of Babylon. 18:21, with such violence, the great city of Babylon will be thrown down. And then, of course, in those words immortalized in Handel's Messiah, hallelujah, salvation and glory and power belong to our God. Then I heard another voice from heaven say, "Come out of her, my people, so that you'll not share in her sins." Of course, talking about that moral distinctiveness, not lack of engagement. So there we are. We don't know what the future holds for our nation. We don't know if we're living in the last generation, but we do know absolutely that this is the last chance for this generation in which we do live. We don't know whether as Christians we'll live out our lives ultimately as a small remnant of believers, or whether by God's grace we will see another great revival in these islands like those of the 18th and 19th century, which completely transform the cultural, legal landscape. It's in God's hands. But regardless of what happens, as God's people, we're called both to be distinctive and to be engaged. Both salt and light, both in the world and not of the world, daring to be different, whilst at the same time seeking the good of the city in which God has placed us. And of course, it will require grace, compassion, courage, and discernment. But it is our calling in this generation, as for every Christian generation, by God's grace and by His Spirit. So there's the challenge of Daniel for us today, how we are to live and to serve in Babylon.